Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. Even though the May issue of Reminisce magazine arrived a bit too late for sharing before Mother's Day, the magazine includes some delightful memories of mothers, which I'll read today. In addition, there's a spotlight article on the year 1967, an article about Little League baseball, something I remember vividly, a few examples of crazy stunts some readers live to tell about, and one reader shares some things about remembering Leffen. And I'm going to be beginning with I Remember Mama. Whether it was a head for figures, a way with words, or a knack of crafts, these mothers had the right tools for making life worthwhile. From Grandma's garden to the sport of kings, Martha Crawford Cantanary, from Denman Island, British Columbia. Henry Ford had nothing on my grandmother. She had her own production line with her three children in her vegetable garden in Durant, Oklahoma in 1914. Grandmother hoed the soil, the oldest poked the hole, the next boy dropped in the seeds, and my future mother, Sharon Crawford, took up the rear, patting down the soil. My mother was a special breed. After getting kicked out of her high school for smoking, she ran away to Dallas and launched her dream of becoming somebody. At 17, she became a model for Neiman Marcus. In 1925, she was especially beautiful and was asked to drive a new automobile in a local parade dressed as a Spanish señorita. Then there was the time that she met my father, Charles F. McKee. He died when I was 6 months old. But in 1930, my mother met a dashing professional polo player, Carl Crawford, on the Texas special train out of St. Louis. They were married 2 years later. My mother's startling beauty led to a screen test at Paramount Studios. But unfortunately, she photographed a lot like Claudette Colbert, which didn't sit well with the movie star. My mother's film career was over before it began. Instead, she poured her energy into working with Carl, who managed several polo clubs from Chicago to California. She also became an official timer for the U.S. Polo Association. By 1939, polo was in full swing in California, and she welcomed the big stars such as Walt Disney and Spencer Tracy, along with famed directors, producers, and writers, to the various clubs Carl managed. My mother's promotion from third in the garden production line in Oklahoma to toast of the Hollywood polo set seems like a dream, but it's all true. And now, prayers answered. Don Witten of Columbia, Maryland, says family lore has it that his mother, Mary, had been praying for a girl, but when her sixth child was born, she mistook the umbilical cord for something else. "Oh my God," she cried, "another boy?" The nurse, Sister Rose Xavier, came to the rescue. "No, Mary, it's a girl, see?" So Mary called her only daughter, Rose Mary, in the nurse's honor. A sacrifice for a daydream believer. This comes from Sue Clancy in Auburn, New York. At 13, living in Auburn, New York in 1967, I thought I'd never stand a chance of seeing my favorite band, the Monkees. Well, surprise number one, my dad came home with tickets for me, my friend Jill, and my mom. Days later, we learned that my cousin was going to the concert in Rochester, too, but by herself. What happened next, I still can't believe. Surprise number two, my mother switched tickets with my cousin so we girls could sit together. Imagine my mom sitting alone with 10,000-plus screaming teeny boppers for 2 hours. What a sacrifice. I remember that after the concert, we had trouble finding each other. We had been seated on different levels. The experience taught me that sometimes parents do understand their teenage children and that a mother will go out of her way to make her child's dream come true. I have lost both of my beloved parents within the last 4 years, but the memories of all they did for me will live on forever. Thanks, Mom and Dad. And here, from Irish Rose, from Bernadette Tone in Ocala, Florida, how well my sister Verona and I recall our days in Drogheda, Ireland, coming in late from local dances, way past our curfew. Our mother, Mona Cullen, would leave a plate of Jacob's cream crackers and a glass of milk at our bedside. It was so like her. Never did she tell our father of the late hour we came in. And she included a photo of her mother, Irish Rose. Mona Cullen was an accomplished violinist as well as a sympathetic mother. Female pastor was a rare calling, this from Lori Williams in Bethany, Oklahoma. Within a few months of graduating from the Cleveland Bible Institute and Training School in the 1920s, my grandmother, Eva Pauline Koontz, assumed the pastorate at the Church of the Nazarene in Syracuse, Ohio. She was 24. In the quiet coal mining village along the Ohio River, the arrival of the new neighbor, let alone a female pastor, was big news. "I was feeling a little strange," the Reverend Koontz noted in her diary. "Notice of my welcome reception is posted on the post office door. I envision her sitting at the petite oak desk with five pigeonholes, the desk that now sits in my living room, praying over sermons and puzzling over budgets. For the week of September 14th, Eva recorded, 6 preaching services, 2 prayer services, 15 calls, 2 open-air services, and salary of $16. Throughout the fall, Eva preached at the coal mines. The rough atmosphere there wasn't about to put her off. As a child, she had gone into the saloons in her hometown of Shelby, Ohio, to retrieve her father, John, who was an alcoholic. Eva went on to marry a schoolteacher, Paul Heyman, and raise their children, including my mother, Marion. They struggled, but the Haymans always shared what they had with those who had even less. And I love this one from Gail Wilkins in Cartersville, Georgia, short and sweet. I remember summer filled with the harvest from my mother's garden. 50 years later, she is still happiest when gardening. And now, what Mom said from Janice Jones of Kingsport, Tennessee. She likes to believe a mother can teach the big things in life with these small, popular sayings. I use some of them with my children and grandchildren, she adds. Hey, if it works, it works. On religion, you better pray that will come out of the carpet. Logic, if you fall down and break your neck, you won't be able to come to the store with me. Genealogy, stop acting like your father. Osmosis, shut your mouth and eat your supper. On stamina, you'll sit there until your spinach is gone. Meteorology, your room looks as if a tornado went through it. Planning for the future, part 1. Make sure you wear clean underwear in case you're in an accident. And planning for the future, part 2. When you get to be my age, you'll understand. And now going on to the spotlight of the year 1967. Turbulent times produced memorable moments. Summer of Love, Age of Aquarius, whatever you call it, 1967 was marked by turmoil and change. The U.S. was embroiled in the Vietnam War, with our troops in the region totaling more than 500,000. Anti-war demonstrations erupted coast to coast. The Supreme Court decreed mixed-race marriages constitutional. DNA was created in a test tube. Television pitched comedy, variety, and intrigue, while music rocked us with the British invasion. Sonny and Cher, one of music's first power duos, and Billboard's top female vocalist, Aretha Franklin. More highlights include January 7th, reality show The Newlywed Game premieres on ABC. January 27th, Fire during the testing of Apollo 1 command module kills its crew, Roger Chaffee, Virgil Gus Grissom, and Edward White. February 22nd, U.S. launches Operation Junction City in Vietnam. C-130s and some 250 helicopters attack Viet Cong bases. April 9th, the first Boeing 737-100 series model makes its maiden flight. April 10th, A Man for All Seasons wins Academy Award for Best Picture. April 27th, Expo 67 opens in Montreal, Quebec. And May 1st, Elvis Presley marries sweetheart Priscilla Ann Beaulieu. May 11th, the 100 millionth U.S. telephone is connected. And June 4th, The Monkees take home an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series. June 5th, Israel launches airstrikes on Egypt, Syria, and Iraq in what would become the Six-Day War. June 12th, the Supreme Court legalizes interracial marriage unanimously. July 19th, the first train of air-conditioned subway cars appears on New York City's F line. August 21, Ken Harrelson becomes baseball's first free agent. And October 2nd, Thurgood Marshall is sworn in as the first Black Supreme Court justice. And December 3rd, Dr. Christian Barnard performs the first human heart transplant in South Africa. Well, the top of the charts in 1967, for TV, it was The Andy Griffith Show, The Lucy Show, Gomer Pyle, USMC, Gunsmoke, Family Affair, and Bonanza. And in music, To Sir With Love by Lulu, The Letter by the Box Tops, Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry, The Association's Windy, and The Monkees' I'm a Believer. And the Beatles find alter ego as a marching band. November 1966 found the Beatles in London's Abbey Road Studios, starting work on an album about their Liverpool childhoods. However, in February of 1967, producer George Martin unexpectedly released their first two tracks, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, as the band's next single. So much for the project. Martin soon realized that the situation now offered an opportunity for the Beatles to create a glorious stew of experimental music. What followed were 700 studio hours of unrestrained productivity, boundary-busting, and often drug-fueled, with Martin pioneering several recording techniques on his then-state-of-the-art four-track tape deck. 5 months later, the question arose: how to tie together all this groundbreaking but rather disparate music? Paul McCartney suggested that they dress in old-time marching band uniforms and play hip psychedelia. That would become the one and only Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Martin loved the idea and had McCartney create the title track, which opened the album and was reprised near the end. Beatles fans were amazed not only by the trippy music tracks, but by the packaging as well. Sgt. Pepper featured a unique, eye-popping fold-out album cover with song lyrics printed on the back. Released on June 1, 1967, Sgt. Pepper was immediately hailed as rock art. Music critics call this album the greatest rock LP ever. Yet Paul has modestly claimed, perhaps with a sly wink, it was just us doing a good show. That written by Randall C. Hall. And now, spring is here. Play ball. One whiff of fresh mown grass, newly oiled leather, and dusty dirt can transport any diehard baseball fan back to the days of bats, balls, and diamond heroics. This story by Frank J. Gagliardi of Millbury, Massachusetts, outfielder's gaffe soon forgotten. I was 12 and playing right field for the Little League Championship in my hometown of Millbury, Massachusetts. The game was scoreless in the top of the last inning with two outs. A batter on the other team lined a base hit to me in the outfield. Against everything I had ever been taught, and over the screams of our coach to throw the ball to second, I committed the cardinal sin of all baseball sins and threw the ball to first base. The ball and the runner arrived at the base at the same time, and all I could see were hats and gloves and bodies flying everywhere. While umpires and coaches tried to sort out what had happened, I wanted to dig a hole in the outfield and climb into it. I was sure I had cost my team the championship. Then the umpires made a ruling that surely pleased one team and outraged the other, declaring the runner out for interfering with a fielder trying to catch a ball. When we all ran off the field, I stood as far from my teammates as possible, sure they wanted to throw me off the team. But suddenly there was a loud roar, and I looked up to see our best hitter line a home run over the center field fence to win the game for us, 1-0. My dumb mistake was forgotten as we mobbed our team at home plate. To top it all off, as was our after-game ritual, we headed to the local dairy bar for ice cream. From A Bat Boy to All-Star by Kenneth G. Zegbell, Michigan City, Indiana. After spending 2 years as a bat boy for the Campbell-Sash Little League team in my hometown of Campbell, Ohio, I was ready to play ball. I arrived at the spring tryouts in 1954 with my birth certificate stating my age. Little League baseball back then was for boys 9 through 12, and a lot of excitement. I signed the registration form in return for a large numbered tag that I pinned to the back of my shirt and wore throughout the tryouts. Each manager and coach carried a clipboard to rate the players they wanted on their teams. On the last day of tryouts, we left and waited for a call. Happily, I got one from the manager of the same team where I had served as a bat boy. The next day, we got our uniforms and black shoes with rubber cleats. I was thrilled to play on our field. It felt just like a miniature major league field, with green grass, soft dirt and sand infield, and honest-to-goodness dugouts. The year I turned 12 was especially memorable. In previous years, I had been a regular season starter and made the All-Star team. But that year, I won the batting title with a .550 average, and as a pitcher, I went 5-1. Our All-Star team won the Ohio State Little League Championship, beating Bridgeport 9-4. The opposing pitcher, Joe Nicro, went on to be a major league pitcher, and I hit a line drive off of him. Our town celebrated with a parade down Main Street. Standing on the city fire truck, we were proud to be champs for a day. The Foul Ball Predicament. This by Gordon Rose of Fishers, Indiana. While I was umpiring a Little League baseball game one summer afternoon in Indianapolis, my son Dan was playing in a league for older kids on the adjacent diamond. Between innings, a boy came running over to tell me that Dan had gotten his head stuck in a fence, but they got him out, the boy said, and he's okay. I waited until my game was over to find out what happened. As the story goes, Dan was playing first base when a batter hit a pop fly into foul territory off the first baseline. Dan ran to catch the ball and collided head first with the chain link fence. His head hit the fence at an angle, just to the right of the fence post. The spring tension allowed the fence to give enough that Dan's head slid between the post and the chain link. There he was, stuck, with the fence post right tight against his neck that he was unable to pull his head back out. A couple of parents got involved and loosened the tension on the chain link, and Dan was able to slide his head out. Then he pointed to his glove, which had come off his hand in the process. The ball was still in the glove. Many years later, Dan ran into one of his former teammates, and the first thing he was asked was, "Have you gotten your head stuck in any fences lately?" Well, here's a little timeline of Little League. In 1939, Carl Stoltz of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, organized the first Little League game. 1947, the first Little League World Series is played, and in 1953, Little Leaguer Joey Jay becomes the first program graduate to reach the major leagues. 1955, George W. Bush, 9, plays the first of his 4 years with Central Little League of Midland, Texas. Bush is the first Little League player to become president. And in 1974, Little League revises its rules to allow girls to participate. Little League softball was created. By the numbers, 2 4/10 million children participate worldwide, with 1.5 million adult volunteers. 21 Little Leaguers have become part of the Baseball Hall of Fame, and they now have 3 programs: Little League Baseball, Softball, and Challengers. And the 9 Little League World Series tournaments are played every year. The league's international tournament is the world's largest elimination contest. Now, retro replay. We're going to a blast from the past. Daredevil Deeds, Conquering Our Fears, One Crazy Stunt at a Time, by Mary Liz Shaw. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the death of Robert Craig Evil Knievel Jr., who leapt to stardom in the 1970s with his daring motorcycle stunts. Evil Knievel almost died trying to jump the fountains at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. He estimated he broke 37 bones over his career. His most ambitious stunt? Jumping Idaho's Snake River Canyon in a rocket motorcycle in 1974. Failed when the drogue parachute opened on takeoff. But Evil roused a nation disillusioned by Watergate and Nixon's resignation. America needed somebody who was truthful and honest, he told Cycle World magazine in 1998. Somebody who wasn't a phony. And here are some stories from readers. Let's go fly a kid. This from my father's crazy airplane buddies who hung out at the local airfield. Gave me some unusual adventures when I was growing up in the 1940s, says Thomas Thurman of Berkeley, California. One Saturday, Jerry, one of the craziest of my favorite of the test pilots, told of an idea he had seen in a magazine. You take a large weather balloon, fill it with helium, and cover it with a parachute. The parachute harness holds the pilot, who wears a belt with several weights. He controls the balloon's action by dropping weights to go up and by releasing gas through the valve on the filler tube to go down. It's called balloon jumping, Jerry said. With the right balance, you can jump and glide over cars and buildings and such. When Jerry mentioned that he had an old weather balloon and a parachute, the group decided to try it. With me. Yeah. He doesn't weigh very much, someone said. Well, they did a test run using a heavy toolbox strapped to a lawn chair. Then it was my turn. I strapped on the harness and the leaded belt as Jerry tied a knotted tether to me. I was so weighted down that I couldn't get the balloon away from the hangar. I started dropping weights one at a time, and soon I felt a little lift. Then my feet came off the ground. I hit the helium valve with my feet, and they grazed the lawn again. I dropped 2 more weights and rose so quickly the tether line zipped through Jerry's hands. He managed to grab one of the line's knots as I floated about 20 feet in the air. It works, Jerry cried. All of the pilots were running along under me, laughing. That was the best feeling ever. I didn't want to come down. But my dad was really shouting now, "Hit the valve! Hit the valve!" I floated down very slowly until Jerry hauled on the line, dragging me down into the middle of the laughing men. And here's a high rider. I have a vivid memory of trudging my tricycle up a steep hill, so steep I had to drag the trike behind me. I tore down that hill at a pretty good clip, then lost control, tipped over, smashed the tricycle, and split my lip open. That was 80 years ago, but I have a constant reminder from that day, a scar. That from Reg Beebe in Brandon, Florida. I love this one. When I was 8, I took a dare from some older boys to dive off the high board at the Abe Marcus swimming pool in Yuma, Arizona. I stood at the end of the board, turned around, and did a backward flip into the water. That from Carol Gallo in Marana, Arizona. Not as easy as it looks. After my husband Ken and his older brother Gene had been to the circus near their home in Ada, Oklahoma, they decided to try a stunt that they had seen the acrobats perform. They centered a 2x12 board on a sawhorse near the chicken house. Ken was to stand on one end of the board while Gene jumped off the chicken house onto the other end. Ken would then fly up, do a mid-air somersault, and land on his feet, or so they hoped. The last thing Ken remembers as he flew up was his knees ramming into his chin. He literally lost stars as he lost consciousness. He awoke flat on his back with his distraught mother above him screaming at Gene, "You've killed my baby!" Ken decided not to be an acrobat when he grew up. That from Charles Stendefier in Stephenville, Texas. And sliding home. We had a playmate in North Hollywood, California in the 50s whose mom worked, so we weren't allowed to play in her house during the day, even though she had an older brother and sister. One day, her brother figured out a game for us that wasn't played inside the house, so technically it was legal. We would crawl up on top of the open garage door, and then someone would close the door so that we could slide down. How we managed to do this over and over without decapitating ourselves is beyond me. And no, I never told my mom. That was from Sue Ann Hilmo of Prescott Valley, Arizona. And another look at 1967, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In aired for the first time on NBC as a special. It was so popular, the network brought it back in 1968 as a mid-season replacement. Hosted by the urbane comedy Dan Rowan and Dick Martin, Laugh-In had frenetic pacing, kooky stars, Goldie Hawn, Lily Tomlin, psychedelic sets, and silly catchphrases like "Suck it to me" and "Look that up in your funkin' wagnalls." Jokes were risque and political. Richard Nixon famously stumbled through "Suck it to me" in a 1968 episode. Another show made fun of the FBI, which earned Laugh-In a permanent agency file. All its zany irreverence made Laugh-In a precursor to Saturday Night Live, which hit NBC in 1975. Well, I hope these stories and vignettes have given you some pleasant memories from 1967 or Little League Baseball, perhaps some of the crazy things that you did as a much younger person. I personally remember those boiled hot dogs at the Little League games. Well, thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you will join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.